Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year's Academy Awards ceremony is 2 weeks from Sunday. True Grit is nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. The film was written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen. We're going to listen back to the interview I recorded with them in January after the film was released. The Coen brothers also wrote and directed Blood Simple, The Big Lebowski, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Fargo, No Country for Old Men, Burn After Reading, and A Serious Man. True Grit is adapted from the Charles Portis Western novel of the same name. Don't think of the film as a remake of the John Wayne movie, which strayed from the novel's story and tone. True Grit is set in the 1870s, when the story begins in Arkansas. A 14-year-old girl named Mattie Ross is setting out to avenge the death of her father, who was murdered in cold blood by a man working for him. With determination and a confidence beyond her years, she looks for a federal marshal willing to track down the murderer and take her along. The marshal she convinces is a one-eyed, often drunk, but fearless Rooster Cogburn, played by Jeff Bridges. Mattie thinks this will be an adventure, but as they get deeper on the trail, she witnesses brutality and death that will transform her. The young Mattie Ross is played by Haley Steinfeld. Let's start with the opening scene from the film. It's a voiceover by the adult Mattie Ross telling the story of what happened when she was 14. The adult Mattie Ross is played by Elizabeth Marvel.
People did not give it credence that a young girl could leave home and go off in the wintertime to avenge her father's blood, but it did happen. I was just 14 years of age when a coward by the name of Tom Chaney shot my father down and robbed him of his life and his horse and two California gold pieces that he carried in his trouser band. Chaney was a hired man, and Papa had taken him up to Fort Smith to help lead back a string of Mustang ponies he had bought. In town, Chaney had fallen to drink and cards and lost all his money. He got it into his head he was being cheated and went back to the boarding house for his Henry rifle. When Papa tried to intervene, Chaney shot him. Chaney fled. He could have walked his horse, for not a soul in that city could be bothered to give chase. No doubt Chaney fancied himself scot-free. But he was wrong. You must pay for everything in this world one way and another. There is nothing free except the grace of God.
Joel and Ethan Coen, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your new film. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
One of the things I love about the movie is that the language is so formal and from an earlier era, an era before contractions were common, an era where, like in the book, people, he's more likely to say, said he, than he said. And some of the dialogue in the movie comes straight out of the book. Some of it you've written. Did you have to learn to write in the language that Charles Portis uses of that era?
Not really. Most of the dialogue is taken from the book, direct from the book. And in places where it wasn't, where we were aping the language of the book because the scenes didn't derive from the original book, it is a strikingly different use of the English language, but it was more a question of aping the tone as opposed to anything more of an exercise than that.
You know, it was a frequent occurrence on the set that an actor would inadvertently use a contraction and we would ask them not to.
The actors actually welcomed that. They wanted to, part of what's interesting about the parts as parts is the language, and they also wanted to be faithful to that.
There's a lot of Old Testament language in this, in part because Mattie, the main character, is very Protestant. And the film opens with a quote from Proverbs, "The wicked flee when none pursueth," which is actually a quote that ends the first chapter of the Charles Portis novel, True Grit. And I want to play a scene in which there's more Old Testament references. And this is a voiceover by the main character, the 14-year-old girl, Mattie. And this is a letter she's writing to her mother explaining she's about to set out on a journey to avenge her father's murder.
Dearest mother, I'm about to embark on a great adventure. I have learned that Tom Chaney has fled into the wild, and I shall assist the authorities in pursuit. You know that Papa would want me to be firm in the right, as he always was. So do not fear on my account. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil. The author of all things watches over me, and I have a fine horse. Kiss little Frankie for me and pinch Violet's cheek. Their Papa's death will soon be avenged. I am off for the Choctaw Nation.
Oh, that's so stirring. So, I mean, in that we hear the formality of language we were talking about, but also, you know, Old Testament references. Did you find yourself going back to the Bible at all to kind of steep yourself in the tone that she would be steeped in?
Not really. No, we didn't go back to the Bible, although clearly the book, the character is steeped in the Bible. Actually, all the characters, you kind of assume that part of their speech derives from either having learned to read from the Bible, or probably a lot of them are illiterate, just having heard a lot of scripture. But no, we didn't go back to the Bible. We're kind of, unlike the main character in the book, we're familiar with it from Hebrew school.
The mood in your version of True Grit comes in part from the cinematography and the colors that you use. Like, the movie is basically brown, gray, and black with some white snow and some kind of off-white sky. It's cloudy most of the time. Even the ad campaign is brown and black.
What's up with that? What's up with that?
Can you talk about deciding that those would be the right colors for the film?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We work and we have worked on the last four movies with a production designer named Jess Gonshore. And sometimes what Jess does before we start is he literally sort of puts together a piece of paper, which is the palette for the movie. You know, you can see the range of colors that he wants to use in the design and in the clothes and, across the board. That was definitely the case on No Country for Old Men. I don't remember him doing that specifically on this movie, but that's very much part of the way he works.
He used to, although he's relaxed a bit, he used to give out, everybody in the art department had the palette and a piece of paper in front of them to make sure that nothing snuck onto the set that was not sanctioned by the palette. Actually, this one, the end of the movie, the palette gets a little more relaxed. There's some color in the Wild West show at the end of the movie just because we wanted to sort of, it had to stand apart from the main body of the movie in some way, and that was a means of doing that. Stand apart in terms of feeling and period.
You know, after seeing your True Grit, I thought, I'll go back and watch the 1969 version with John Wayne, because I'd never really seen before. I'd seen a couple of minutes here and there while channel surfing, but that's about it. And with all due respect to those involved, I really thought it was a bad film. And it's
with
funny.
With all due respect to the Duke. You know, I must say, we saw the movie when it came out when we were kids. We haven't seen it since, although we did see the trailer. And it's in so many ways shocking.
Yes. Well, one of the shocking things is, like, we're talking about how your film is like brown, gray, and black. And that's like this Technicolor film with the bright colors. And she's wearing like an orange skirt or something, you know, at one point. I mean,
it's a little assaultive, isn't it?
Yeah, which just seems so wrong.
There are parts of it that actually seem a little campy to us now.
And again, this is just judging from the trailer, but.
It's a curious thing. People have a real attachment to that original movie. It actually, we were very tempted at certain points and while we were shooting the movie to go back and watch it again. And, you know, you just inevitably sometimes reach the point where you go, I wonder how they did it in the first one. But we never ended up actually going back to it. Roger Deakins,
who shot the movie,
he did consult it, and it frequently came up to us when he had, like, we were shooting something at night, and he'd have, you know, 18 Ks on a ridge up in, you know, the middle of nowhere trying to light this exterior scene. He would say to Ethan and I, you know, in the original one, they just shot this during the day. We didn't go back and look at it.
So you had to work with horses in this film. Through most of the movie, all the characters are on horseback, going through the woods looking for the man who they're trying to capture. And working with horses is probably pretty hard. I don't know how much you've done that before.
We sort of approached the whole enterprise with a great deal of trepidation. We were... And they are difficult to deal with for a number of reasons. I should say, however, that we were lucky enough to have the services of probably the best horse wranglers in the business. And they do extraordinary things with the horses. The horses will often hit their marks in ways that you sometimes wish the actors were capable of doing. But, you know, we were doing a lot of very complicated things with the horses, and the whole sort of enterprise of doing stunts with horses now is a lot different than it was when we were watching, you know, the Westerns that we saw as kids when those were being made. There are restrictions on what you can do with animals in general and horses in particular, which are there for very good reasons. For instance, if you want a horse to fall down, that's a much, much different thing than it was 20 years ago.
What's different?
Well, you used to be able to basically trip horses. You're not allowed to do that anymore. Again, as Joel said, for good reason, for perfectly valid reasons, but it makes it very difficult. The horses have to be trained, and basically they have to want to fall down.
So you have to have stunt horses.
Yeah. You have to have stunt horses that are trained, that'll fall down, the ground has to be prepared where they fall. Generally speaking, they have to be ridden by the trainer as opposed to by sort of, you know, stuntman X or the actor. There are rules that involve how moving vehicles, by which, I mean, in this context, you know, moving camera cars can approach horses that are moving towards the vehicle.
There are even rules, some of them seem actually a little excessive, about we swim a horse in the movie, and there are rules about water temperature at which you're allowed to swim the horse, which seems odd because, you know, we were throwing actors in there with the horses and the actors weren't complaining.
there's no union rules about the actors.
No, there's frequently things that you can do with actors that you can't do with animals. I mean, that's actually quite common. You know, what's the temperature of the water? But right, the union isn't saying anything about putting the 13-year-old in freezing water.
There's a scene where there's a pony that's carrying more weight than the pony can carry. And the pony is played out. It cannot endure anymore. And it is choking and sputtering and coughing. What do you do to get a horse to do that?
Well, that's cobbling together a lot of different things, because you can't certainly distress a horse, certainly not to that degree. It's a lot of things. It's riding at different paces, and we just, you know, progressively slower. A lot of it is enhanced digitally in the computer in terms of its lather and its breath, and actually a lot of it is sound. I mean, just the sound of the horse's effort, which is all fake, added later, contributes a lot to the impression of distress.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is the horse's just sort of apparent movement through the frame, and also tricks that they do, for instance, to get the horse to open its mouth, to bare its teeth, to, you know, flare its nostrils, those types of things, which are part of the way you cut it all together to create the impression that the horse is being ridden down to this point of exhaustion. The horse was perfectly fine and able to do it as much as we wanted. The horse was actually not experiencing any of that.
You never heard him complain.
So you had to take all these precautions with the horses, but the star of your film is a 13-year-old girl. Were there precautions you had to take with her as a minor? Were her parents on the set? Did she have some kind of guardian on the set? Are there rules?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. There are rules in terms of child labor. The one that was difficult to deal with, just because you're making a movie and trying to make the days, you know, get the day's work done, related to her hours on the set, which are restricted, and you're not allowed to shoot with a minor, with a 13-year-old, past midnight. So when you're doing a night scene, especially, it's especially onerous because it doesn't get dark till 8 or 8:30, and the main character leaves at midnight. That kind of presents a working problem. But, you know, that's we knew what we were getting into shooting a movie with horses and a 13-year-old.
It makes scheduling the movie enormously more complicated, and it does force you, unfortunately, in certain situations to do scenes or the coverage of Jeff or Matt, for instance, sometimes had to be done with another actor who was essentially standing in for Haley at that point, because you still have to shoot the day.
So, as a rule, if you're in the movie, if you're looking at a shot of Jeff or Matt over the shoulder of the character Maddie, it's usually not Haley, but usually an adult double in her wardrobe.
I don't know if this is a conscious decision on your part, but it seems to me you did not sexualize the character of the 14-year-old girl.
Well, that's a whole interesting issue. You know, we were aware of the fact that that part was played by Kim Darby, and she was in her early 20s when she played the part. But it's so clear from the novel that what's very interesting about what Charles Portis did in the novel is he made the protagonist just on the brink of puberty, of sort of sexual awareness. I mean, just on that weird edge between being a child and between being an adolescent or a sexual creature. And it's part of what's interesting about the whole dynamic between her and the two men in the story. And no, we didn't want to sexualize it, but on the other hand, there's the sort of sexual element of them and her age is part of the story and part of what we wanted to be there.
It's really one of the great female roles, because she's so strong and independent and willful and yet naive and vulnerable at the same time. Of course, she's only 13. I mean, it's a role that I think like great actresses would have fought for, but they're far too old to play it. So let me play a scene with Haley Steinfeld as the young Maddie Ross and Jeff Bridges as Rooster Cogburn, the one-eyed, hard-drinking, hygienically incorrect deputy marshal for the U.S. District Court of the Western District of Arkansas. And so she's been trying to convince him to help her track down Chaney, the man who killed her father, so she can avenge her father's death. And she's been negotiating the price that she would pay Rooster Cogburn. Here's Haley Steinfeld and Jeff Bridges.
Can we depart this afternoon?
We? You are not going. That is no part of it.
You have misjudged me if you think I'm silly enough to give you $50 and watch you simply ride off.
I'm a bonded U.S. Marshal.
That weighs but little with me. I will see the thing done.
I've been the duck. I can't go after Ned Pepper and a band of hard men look after a baby at the same time.
I am not a baby.
I won't be stopping at boarding houses where there's warm beds and hot grub on the table. I'll be traveling fast, eating light. A little sleeping is done to take place on the ground.
Well, I have slept out at night before. Papa took me a little Frank Coon hunting last summer on the Petit Jean. We were in the woods all night. We sat around a big fire and yarn and all told ghost stories. We had a good time.
Coon hunting? This ain't no coon hunt.
It is the same idea as a coon hunt.
Don't come on in 40 miles, baby.
You were just trying to make your work sound harder than it is. Here's the money. Now, I am to get Tom Chaney, and if you are not game, I will find somebody who is game. All I've heard out of you so far is talk. I know you can drink whiskey and snore and spit and wallow in filth and bemoan your station. The rest has been braggadocio. They told me you had grit, and that is why I came to you. I'm not paying for talk. I can get all the talk I need and more at the Monarch boarding house.
Leave your money. Meet me here at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. We'll begin our coon hunt.
That's the scene from True Grit, and my guests are the writers and directors, Joel and Ethan Coen. I think that scene really shows how she's both a girl and mature way beyond her years at the same time. And did you write this knowing that you'd want to cast Jeff Bridges in the part of Rooster Cogburn?
Well, we didn't actually write it thinking about Jeff. You know, sometimes as an exercise when we're writing a script of our own, just as a sort of a crutch in figuring out who the characters are. We imagine specific actors that we know in a part in order to kind of crystallize what the part is, what the character is. In this case, that wasn't what we were doing. We were just adapting the book. The characters were sort of given to us. So we wrote the screenplay as an adaptation without really thinking about actors who might play the parts. When we were done, though, And, you know, beginning to size up, figure out where we were. Jeff was the first person who suggested himself as the, you know, the person to play Rooster Cogburn. Yeah.
You know, it's a short list again. You know, at that age, that kind of physicality, I mean, in terms of people who are sort of in that, in the pocket that could play that. And Jeff just seemed to us the most... I mean, quite aside from the fact that we'd worked with him before and had, and really liked him, the most interesting in the part.
Plus, he can ride.
Oh, he can ride.
Although
horses.
I must say, we didn't know that at the time. I guess I'm reflecting. If we thought about it, we knew
it
was.
Yeah. He, you know, it was an issue with all of the characters, really. I mean, they had to spend half the movie on horseback.
I'd like to talk about your previous film, A Serious Man, which I think is a wonderful film and really funny. It's set in 1967 in a suburb of Minneapolis, and it's about a man who's beset by problems. He's a physics teacher who thinks he's about to get tenure until he's blackmailed by one of his students seeking a higher grade. His wife is leaving him for another man. His brother seems to be going mad. His son is about to be bar mitzvahed, but is spending more time getting high on marijuana than studying the Haftorah. And the TV isn't getting good reception. So it's about a man
That's
who...
That's a good movie pitch.
Yeah.
Kid, you got a picture.
So as everything in his life is falling to pieces, he decides he's going to seek the advice of his rabbi. But he goes to a series of rabbis, and what they say is, like, not helpful, and sometimes it makes no sense at all. What was the germ of this idea for the film, of this man who is beset by problems, not boils like Job, but, like, 1967 kind of problems, and he goes to the rabbi.
No boils, but his brother has a sebaceous cyst.
That's right.
On the back of
his neck. That's right.
What was the germ? What was the beginning of it? Mm-hmm. Is that the question?
Yeah.
Well, interestingly, the beginning of it proceeded from a very early discussion we had about possibly doing a short movie about a rabbi that we did know when we were growing up, who was sort of loosely based on the eldest rabbi, the rabbi that's called Marshak in A Serious Man, who was a sort of mysterious figure who... Each of the bar mitzvah kids would go in and see just after their bar mitzvah. But no, we weren't really quite sure what happened in that room with this rabbi after you were bar mitzvahed and you went in and you had a little chat with him. This rabbi, by the way, wasn't at the synagogue that we went to. It was at another synagogue in town. We thought, well, it might be interesting to make a short movie just about, you know, a bar mitzvah boy going into that room to have that chat with the rabbi.
So when you were getting bar mitzvahed, you know, in that era when you had to study in Hebrew school for the bar mitzvah, would it ever have occurred to you to ask a rabbi for advice? Or to turn to a rabbi as a child? Yes, to turn to a rabbi
No.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. No. No, you know, like most kids who get spiritual instruction, religious instruction, it was a chore. It wasn't anything connected to any real life problems. No.
Did you feel that way about the synagogue in general?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hebrew school and going to the synagogue was all, as I say, a chore. You know, it was something you had to do after secular school.
And did you ever feel any different about it?
No. honestly, I think we both stopped going as soon as our parents let us stop. My sister had set a very dangerous precedent by continuing after her bat mitzvah. So that was something that I remember having an early discussion with my mother about in terms of, you know, saying, I don't think this is going to work with me. But I don't feel a whole lot differently about it.
Before then, through our bar mitzvahs, we had real immersion. We went to Hebrew school 4 days a week after regular school and then the synagogue on Saturday. And, you know, a summer camp, Jewish summer camp in the summer. It was pretty...
We went to Hebrew school 5 days a week.
Oh, yeah, and Sunday morning as well. Yeah.
One of the things I love about the film is that although the husband-father character in it, college teacher, doesn't connect with the rabbis he's talking with, at the end, and I don't want to give away the ending, so I'm going to try to talk about this in such a way so that I don't give away the ending. There is something truly...
Surprise ending.
Yeah, there's something truly awesome. And I don't mean like, wow, awesome. I mean like that creates a feeling of overwhelming awe at the very end. And there's
again,
two things,
actually.
Without getting specific. And at that point...
Part of it's an artifact of living in the Midwest and being the, setting the story in the spring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have weather patterns. We'll leave it at that.
Okay. But I'm very interested in the way that the rabbis seem kind of somewhere between like odd, out of it, superficial, and yet there is this feeling of awe that you express in the film. And again, this comprehension that we die. And that awe may or may not be connected to any religion, but there is still awe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are you waiting for a question? I don't know what the question
yeah.
is.
Right. What you were talking about with the ending was something which we were sort of trying to put in a rational context for the area and the period and the moment and the scene, something that felt as biblical as possible at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped to sort of contribute to, I think, at least in some emotional way, the things that you were just talking about. As far as the rabbis were concerned, the rabbis were, they're just like everybody else. If you have as much experience going to synagogues and Hebrew schools as we did as little kids, you meet a lot of different rabbis and you know, there are a lot of characters.
And also, some of them are almost laughable, maybe, but not just laughable. They're not, I don't think they're dismissible.
Right. That's true. I mean, just to say that they don't do him, meaning Larry, the main character in the movie, any good, is not the same thing as saying that they're dismissible, as Ethan said.
Actually, the second one kind of makes sense.
Well, when he meets the junior rabbi at one point, and the rabbi is so much younger than he is, it's like, you know, he's thinking, how can you possibly have wisdom that I don't? You're young.
Well, you know, that actually is interesting because, you know, when our mother passed away, we were at home and we were visited. My father asked a rabbi to come from the synagogue to just pay, and I think that's something they do customarily, to pay a visit to the bereaved family. And this kid walked in and looked like he was 12. And I remember thinking, wow, you've gotten old and the rabbis have gotten a lot younger.
It's hard to think of him as a spiritual leader. But yeah, that was done in the movie by a very funny actor named Simon Helberg. He spent so much time preparing for it, and we shot the whole scene in one morning. We talked about reconvening every year on the anniversary of the shoot day so we could redo the scene, but I think we've all kind of forgotten about it.
Yeah, Simon, I think, was cast before we ended up making this movie, Burn After Reading, before we made A Serious Man. But we cast Simon in A Serious Man before we made Burn After Reading, and he comes on the set and he said, you know, I've been rehearsing this scene every day for a year. 2 hours later, he was out of there.
So I want to play a scene from the film, and this isn't a rabbi scene. This is a scene where the main character, you know, he's learned that his wife is wants a divorce, and she wants a Jewish divorce, a get. And the man that she is now in love with is Cy Abelman, who looks like, he kind of looks like if Allen Ginsberg wasn't a beat poet, but he was like a suburban guy who dressed in pale blue pants and a pale blue polo shirt and was into like stealing your wife away from you, but was also very touchy-feely and sensitivo about it all. That uh-huh. could be this guy.
Yeah, it's all very moist.
Yes.
He actually resembles sort of a combination of Francis Coppola and another Alan, Alan Sherman.
An older Alan Sherman.
That's really funny. For anybody who doesn't know Alan Sherman, Alan Sherman was, like, in the 60s, during the folk music craze, he did these, like, folk song parodies of popular songs, but all with, like, parody Jewish lyrics. So you had right. to be very Jewish, I think, to think that they were funny or to even get some of the jokes. They were all about, like, heartburn and going to summer camp. But then anyways.
Crabgrass and Harvey and Sheila was the Hava Nagila parody.
So, okay, so here's the scene. So Larry has been forced by his soon-to-be ex-wife and the man she's in love with now to a diner so that they can work things out with him. He really does not want to be there. So here he is with Cy Abelman, his new rival, and his wife.
Larry, I want to thank you for coming. It's so important we be able to discuss these things.
I'm happy to come to Ambersye, but I'm thinking, really, maybe it's best to leave these discussions to the lawyers.
Of course. Legal matters, you let the lawyers discuss. You don't mix apples and oranges.
I have begged you to see the lawyer.
I told you I'm going Monday.
Monday is timely. This is not... Please, Embers is not the forum for legalities. You're so right. Mm. No, Judith and I wanted merely to discuss... practicalities, living arrangements. After all, this is an issue where no one is at odds.
Living arrangements?
I think we all agree that the children not being contaminated with the tension, most important.
We shouldn't put the kids in the middle of this, Larry.
The kids aren't...
I'm saying we. I'm not pointing fingers.
No one is playing the blame game, Larry.
I didn't say anyone was.
Well, let's not play he said, she said either.
I wasn't.
All right, look. Let's just take a step back and we can diffuse the situation. You know, Larry, sometimes I find that if I count to 10, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, poor Larry. He's so innocent in this situation. And Cy Abelman is so insufferable. Cy Abelman's putting his hand over Larry's hand during this scene and this, like, touchy-feely thing. Can you talk about creating this character? I love this character.
He was based on, at least in part, on a couple of people that we knew growing up. I don't want to say who for obvious reasons.
but we added a lot of horrible, warm empathy, which Fred Melamed, the actor, certainly made hay with.
So what did they do that made them insufferable?
Well, you know, our parents were both academics, and so a lot of the people that we knew were insufferable.
Ethan, you just made yourself a lot of friends in the academy. As frequently happens when, especially in this case, I mean, because we were writing about a community that we grew up in, a lot of these characters were sort of amalgamations of a couple of different people. Although, you know, it's interesting. You talk about sort of sexualizing characters in the context of True Grit, but Fred Melamed came in to do an initial reading of this, and he immediately recognized it. You know, he'd read the script, and he said, basically what he said was, oh, I'm the sex guy. And, you know, that actually added a whole other dimension.
Since the film A Serious Demand is modeled in part on the community you grew up in, were there things from your old home that you saved that you would put in the home of the main characters of their family, or things that
there
you...
Was not that we saved, things. But that we found, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. What things?
There are certain totems of that period, a Jewish middle-class Jewish household of that period. We tried to get a copy of, what was it, the Abba Eban book onto the every home set that we had.
Masada.
Masada, yeah. Yigal Alon's book.
Yeah. What else did we have?
Didn't we get your Kiddush cup into the movie?
Yes, the Kiddush cup that was... Actually, the Kiddush cup that I was given at my bar mitzvah.
It is presented to the bar mitzvah boy at the end of the movie. But again, Jess Gonchore, the designer of True Grit, designed that movie as well. And Jess grew up in the same kind of household in Mamaroneck, not in the Midwest. But he certainly knew he knew what we were looking for.
I have a friend who also grew up in a similar community at a similar time who came and visited the set when we were shooting in that house. And he walked into the house, it almost, you know, had, it went into some kind of, you know, anaphylactic shock from, Yeah, from the different things that he recognized from his own household.
There's a lot of scenes where people are eating at the kitchen table in their homes, and it's just like the family, the nuclear family around the kitchen table. And I think this is an era where you usually did not eat out. You ate at home, and everybody is chewing and slurping so loudly in a way that you probably would not do in public, but you do in your own home with your family.
Yeah,
was that intentional?
Yeah, the soup slurping was kind of the scene.
Is that how you remember your family eating, everybody chewing and slurping a little too
loud?
Yes,
and it's also true that, right, you never ate out. And if you did, it was at the sort of local, you know, delicatessen or, in this case, we actually used a, he says Embers is not the place for legalities. And that was kind of the family restaurant down the block that we would go to occasionally.
But yeah, people eating in silence. I mean, there wasn't the – there's kind of a contemporary thing where you're supposed to talk to your children and everyone's supposed to be engaged. This is before all of that.
So can you tell us something about your bar mitzvahs, since A Serious Man has something to do with bar mitzvahs?
It's probably inevitable that we had to be asked that because there is a bar mitzvah scene in the movie where the bar mitzvah boy is high, is, you know, stoned on marijuana. But ours were both I don't remember anything out of the ordinary about mine. It was certainly not that. It was just, you know, you read your Torah portions, Haftorah, and, you know, you got your presents, and that was that.
There actually, you know, now that you mention it, there was one element that does derive directly from our own bar mitzvahs and a habit of the rabbi that that we had at the time. And that was this moment where he gave the bar mitzvah boy the Kiddush cup, and you would reach up to take it, and he essentially would grab your hand on it and then hold you captive there while he finished his spiel.
Yeah, that was kind of our first, or mine, probably both of ours, our first experience to show business, because you're standing there and the rabbi is kind of projecting in your face this speech and smiling at you. And it becomes, as you're his prisoner, as Joel describes, it becomes more and more artificial and weird. I felt like I was high, although I wasn't at the time. A very strange kind of performance thing. It was, yeah, that was a weird moment.
So you both love movies. You both make movies. How did you fall in love with movies, and did you fall in love with them at the same time, or did older brother introduce them to younger brother?
Well, we both watched movies on TV just because, you know, you did. Everyone did. And we both, you know, liked movies. We both fooled around with movies as kids. You know, we got a little Super 8 camera.
But most of our movie watching as kids, that was, you know, it was on television. It wasn't going to movie theaters.
Television was this great repertory movie house then.
It was.
It still is, and if you want it to
yes.
be. Yeah, it was great.
No, it
stuff
was,
on.
And it was curated in a peculiar way that that actually sort of retrospectively, you know, if you look back on it, is really interesting.
There was this guy in Minneapolis named Mel Jass who had a matinee movie. It was the afternoon movie, and it was very different then than now. Now you have all these choices. But here, as Joel says, he was the curator. If you wanted to watch movies, you watched what Mel Jass had programmed. And he would have, you know, Hercules movies, but he would also have, you know, 8 and a half. He'd bought probably the Joe Levine catalog, so he had all the Italian movies. So that was kind of our high-low introduction to movies.
That's funny. And did he talk during the movies?
He sold Munz TVs in the commercial breaks. And he was, you know, he was the typical, you know, sort of a silver-haired guy in a
bad suit.
In a bad suit and comfortable chair, and you come back to him and during the breaks. And
but, yeah, all the commercials were live, and he would do the pitch, but he would also give his commentary on the movie.
He would, and it was, you know, it was a great commentary, actually. It was very, you know, it was very Midwestern.
You know, 8 and a half, you go, wow, this one's crazy, isn't it?
Did movies seem magical when you were young? And if so, do they still seem that way now that you have to make them and get the budget for them and deal with the horses for them? And you know,
no, you know, we had to look behind the curtain. It's terrible in a way.
But you love it, probably, no?
Yes, but what you're saying is true. That it does, you know, the magical aspect of it is sort of, you can't retrieve that after you've looked behind the curtain.
Yeah, it's all kind of shocking and horrible that we've become show folk. We're not, we're not just watching them anymore.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been fun. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Terry. Yep.
Joel and Ethan Coen's latest film, True Grit, is nominated for 10 Oscars. The Oscar ceremony is 2 weeks from Sunday. Our interview was recorded in January. This is Fresh Air. Just over 2 years ago, few people knew Justin Bieber outside his small hometown in Ontario, Canada. Today, he's a worldwide teen pop star and the center of the new concert film called Justin Bieber, Never Say Never. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
On our way to see the concert documentary Justin Bieber, Never Say Never, my not yet 13-year-old daughter asked, "Dad, do you think they'd mind if during the movie I screamed?" I said I thought the studio would be thrilled if she screamed. She'd prove she was a Bieber maniac, a Belieber. The film, as it happens, is packed with little girls screaming and moaning and weeping. I'd have screamed if I was in marketing, because this is one awesome piece of packaging. The key, of course, is that Bieber is presented as a grassroots phenomenon, someone who rose without corporate packaging. Never Say Never opens with a computer screen and a mouse clicking on well-known YouTube viral videos, laughing babies, cute dogs, and so on. Then there's a YouTube video of little Justin in a paneled room, a small-town kid with a big-city voice. "Hey, check out this kid," reads a fake but representative email. Bieber is, we're told, the first social network superstar. The movie is cunningly woven to show the tension between his insane success and his determination to remain a sane, normal 16-year-old. His background helps. His teenage mom and dad split when he was 10 months old, but we're told he always had the love of his mother and her parents, not to mention God and Jesus. He wasn't hatched in a studio incubator. His talent manager, Scott Scooter Brown, first saw him on YouTube. He couldn't interest record companies, though, because Bieber didn't have the requisite connection to Disney or Nickelodeon. So Brown enlisted Usher, whom Bieber idolized. But in the end, says Brown, Bieber sold himself.
Every label says no platform for him. Justin was looking at me like, when are we going to do something? Hand-to-hand combat is what we did. We put Justin in a van and on airplanes. He just got focused on what we had to do.
All right, Q102 live in the studio, Justin Bieber.
What's up, guys? Justin, what are you going to sing for us right now?
I'm going to perform one time right now. When I met you, girl, my heart
went knock, knock. There's not a DJ that can say they have not met Justin Bieber. And he won people over.
Wow.
That was nice, man.
Justin Bieber, do not forget us, bro. Don't forget us.
He started twittering. I'm going to be at this radio station. I'm going to be at this radio station. First 20 kids, then 40 kids, then 100 kids, then a couple hundred kids started lining up outside of these radio stations to just get a glimpse of him. And they started to play his record.
Director John M. Chu jumps back and forth between Bieber's rise and the countdown to his sold-out concert at Madison Square Garden. The pinnacle, the movie says. 10 days to Madison Square Garden. 9 days to Madison Square Garden. Since Bieber is already playing to sold-out arenas, there's little in the way of suspense. Until he starts to lose his voice and has to cancel a show in Syracuse. A doctor arrives. There's a close-up of Justin's inflamed tonsils. Will he be able to play the Garden? You gotta believe. Unlike most packaged teen idols, Bieber has a voice that needs no help from sound mixers, and home movies show he had uncannily slick moves from an early age. Having risen out of the social network, he has more communication tools at his disposal than, say, Donny Osmond in his day. In the middle of his song Baby, he raps, "Yeah, I'm 16 and I thought that you'd be mine. I used to tweet you and text you and call you and hit you on Facebook all the time. Can't believe that you did me wrong. We were on iChat all night long." Wow, iChatting all night long. That is serious. No wonder one fan gushes, "I think about him like 99% of my life." Another says, "One day I tweeted him 100 times. He's really hot," adds a child who looks closer in years to diapers than puberty. In concert, one girl is always pulled from her seat to sit on a stool on stage during his signature number, "One Less Lonely Girl." As the girl here weeps and weeps, as Bieber descends on her with a bouquet of flowers, I checked out my daughter and her friend, both rapt, both crying. I find him such a white and pious and profoundly unthreatening little Furby robot of a pop star, but little girls' celebrity crushes are not to be trifled with. And this expertly engineered promo film makes Justin Bieber look like a force of nature.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can see clips from the Justin Bieber film on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Special thanks to Manoli Wetherill for recording the performance by Ed Helms and his band earlier this week. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.